This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castillo.
I am fighting every day for the great people of this country. Therefore, in order to fulfill my solemn duty to protect America and its citizens, the United States will withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, but begin negotiations to re-enter either the Paris Accord or in really entirely new transaction.
That's U.S. President Donald Trump from June 1st when he announced his intent to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Change Agreement. The Paris Climate Accord was created in 2015 when 195 countries promised to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and avoid the most catastrophic impacts of climate change. The president's decision was enthusiastically applauded and praised by many of his supporters, including the top GOP congressional leadership. But the move to leave the Paris Accord was harshly criticized by leaders of many U.S. allied countries, as well as a number of U.S. governors, over 250 mayors of major U.S. cities, and many business leaders. Today on Encounter, we're going to discuss the U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accord, along with possible ramifications of this decision. We'll talk about this issue in two segments. First, the possible political and then the economic aspect of the president's decision. And I'd like to welcome my co-host for today, VOA science correspondent Steve Barragona.
Hi, Rick.
Joining us via telephone for our first segment of today's program is Samantha Gross, a fellow in the Cross Brookings Initiative on Energy and Climate at the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C. And Nicholas Loris is the Herbert and Joyce Morgan Fellow in Energy and Environmental Policy at the Center for Free Markets and Regulatory Reform at the Heritage Foundation, also in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the two of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Samantha, my first question is for you. What does President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Change Agreement actually mean to you?
Well, pulling out of the Paris Accord doesn't really impact domestic policy. He'd already done a lot of the things that really make a difference domestically, pulling back on the Clean Power Plan, for instance. The real issue with pulling out of Paris is it's a symbolic issue internationally. It greatly damages our standing abroad. The U.S. really pushed for flexibility in the Paris Accord, which is what allowed it to be nearly universally accepted. And pulling out of it now is a real challenge for our allies.
And Nicholas, your comment?
Yeah, well, I think it does the opposite. In fact, I think it shows strong leadership in the fact that Paris, like many of the other international agreements dating back to Kyoto and even dating back further to the entire United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, has been really a costly, ineffective tool to addressing climate change. I think no matter where you are in terms of the urgency of the problem. And I think if you look at the foreign leaders, they were going to be upset with President Trump's energy policy, regardless of whether he withdrew from Paris or not. They're not going to be happy that he not contribute any more money to the Green Climate Fund, that he's rolling back the greenhouse gas regulations implemented by the Obama administration. And although there has been criticism, the United States is going to remain a global superpower and is going to have input on a multitude of issues, ranging from security, economic issues, diplomatic issues, as well as addressing climate change. I don't think pulling out of Paris precludes the United States from working with other countries to study climate change, understanding why and how it's happening. And also, if we do think that it's an issue worth addressing, what are the best steps to take to address climate change at the lowest possible cost?
Nicholas, I'm curious, what is the difference of President Trump withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Accord compared to former President George W. Bush pulling out of the Kyoto Accords in 2001?
Honestly, I don't think there's that much. If you look at the countries that were not part of Kyoto, I think we were talking about Afghanistan and Somalia. And, you know, the Trump administration faced a lot of criticism because the only countries not in Paris were, I think it was Nicaragua?
Yeah, Nicaragua.
That's right, yeah. And so I don't think there's that much. I mean, there were a lot of criticism from the industrialized countries when Bush didn't ratify or move forward with Kyoto. And although that criticism was loud, the Bush administration was able to overcome it and work with other governments on numerous international issues of mutual concern. I think the same will hold true for President Trump's repudiation of Paris.
And I think there's an important difference in withdrawing from Paris versus not ratifying Kyoto. And the difference is the difference in the underlying agreement. The Kyoto Agreement was really set in this notion of who was ultimately responsible for old emissions. And we ended up with a battle between developed and developing countries. And the U.S. was rightly somewhat frustrated that there were no responsibilities put on developing countries, whereas the Paris Accord was negotiated such that each country brought in its own goals. And so that allowed each country to be able to sign on. The Paris Accord, all those countries may have been involved in the Kyoto Agreement, but these countries actually brought in goals to the Paris Accord. The Paris Accord really set aside this old disagreement between developed and developing countries, and allowed each country to bring in what it was willing to do.
And I would argue that despite this alleged kumbaya moment between the developed world and the developing world in Paris, it really continues to perpetuate a business-as-usual scenario for the developing world. I mean, China doesn't have to peak its emissions until 2030, and they've repeatedly falsified their coal consumption and CO2 emissions, as well as their air monitoring data.
But China is moving, and India is moving.
India has pledged to reduce its emissions intensity, or its cuts in the ratio of CO2 emissions to GDP. And so that ratio will go down so long as CO2 emissions rise less rapidly than GDP, but CO2 emissions are allowed to increase. And then you have other countries like Pakistan that, in their nationally determined contribution, say that there will be an exponential increase of GHG emissions for many decades is likely to occur before any decrease can be expected. So because there's non-binding commitments and there's no repercussions for failing to abide by these commitments, I see this as really just kind of more fluff than anything else.
So, Nicholas, what you're saying that there's not much here, in your opinion, what has the United States gained then by pulling out of this accord, other than irritating our allies and alienating, according to polls, most of the population and most of the business community?
Well, I think it's an acknowledgement that this is a costly, ineffective approach to addressing climate change, and that there still is this very big divide between the developed and the developing world. And if you look at the number of coal-fired power plants that are going to be constructed worldwide, the Climate Action Tracker in a 2015 report put it at more than 2,400 coal-fired power plants.
And fewer all the time as China scales down its coal consumption, as India scales down its coal consumption.
But you're still talking about thousands of coal-fired power plants coming on. It may be less than projected, but you're still talking about thousands worldwide. I mean, that's a significant number. And we can talk about investments in nuclear power and renewable technologies, and they certainly can play a role if they're driven by market forces. But I think we just have to acknowledge the realities that there's more than a billion people without affordable, dependable power, that addressing energy poverty, which is an immediate known risk, is very important, and more so important than addressing a distant, uncertain risk of climate change over the next few centuries.
Samantha, I'm wondering what agreements, what other political fallout you see as kind of the immediate consequences of this from our allies? Are there other agreements, other issues that you see as being harder to accomplish because of the Trump administration's actions on Paris?
I'd like to back up for a minute to respond to what Nick just said.
Sure.
One thing that I'd like to point out is the Paris Agreement is not perfect. I completely agree with you on that point. However, we can't let getting the perfect agreement that gets us all the way to where we need to go get in the way of getting started. Of course, we're going to have disagreements between developed and developing countries. And of course, developing countries are going to have more issues with reducing and even slowing the rate of increase of their emissions because they're in a very different spot in their development curve. The Paris Agreement has a mechanism to improve these commitments over time. What the agreement has is that countries go back and revisit their goals every 5 years with the idea that they will become more ambitious over time as technologies improve, as the cost for technologies come down. And so we can't let the perfect get in the way of the good or the perfect get in the way of getting started with respect to the Paris Agreement.
Yeah, and so are there specific issues that you see as being more difficult with the United States having pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord?
The Green Climate Fund is important. The United States did promise to contribute $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund, and they've put $1 billion in already. But there are other countries that are also contributing, and the Green Climate Fund is moving along. Something that I think is going to be really important going forward is how our allies feel about us pulling out, because it doesn't really impact domestic policy. The U.S. can do what it wants with respect to climate policy, and it could before we withdrew from the agreement. That hasn't really changed. But the challenge is that this makes our president and this administration much more unpopular abroad. And if you look at our allies, most of them are democracies. Those leaders have to respond to voters. And this makes cooperating with the United States less popular among the voters in our allied countries. So this could really be a challenge for us.
Nick, I'm wondering about the consequences at home. If there are no policy ramifications, are there political ramifications? Because this was not a terribly popular move.
Well, I would disagree with, you know, how that ultimately plays out. I mean, this is something that President Trump campaigned on and ultimately won in getting out of bad agreements, including what he said was canceling the Paris Agreement. And so I think this is fulfilling a campaign promise. And if you look at what folks say in terms of whether they want action on climate change, it tends to be supportive. And then if you ask them how much they're willing to pay for action on climate change, it's very little, essentially about a dollar a day. And so if you look at all the domestic regulations that came with President Obama's nationally determined contributions, the Clean Power Plan, the new source performance standards on new power plants that would effectively ban the construction of new coal-fired power plants here in the United States.
Which are already closing.
This bans the construction of new coal-fired power plants. It doesn't even give them a chance to compete in the marketplace. And we can say that they're already closing. Some of that is because of regulation. Some of that is because of cheap natural gas. But that's for the market to determine if they're closing as a result of economic unsustainability. That's fine. When we have 500 years worth of coal underneath our soil, artificially restrict the use of that resource by banning the construction of new coal-fired power plants. If they can find ways, we see technologies getting better and more innovative and lowering the cost all the time. Why can't coal do that as well if they're given the chance to compete?
Well, with that, we must wrap things up. Our guests in this segment of our program were Samantha Gross from the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C., and Nicholas Loris from the Heritage Foundation, also in Washington, D.C. Samantha, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining our conversation today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Here's a reminder that Encounter can also be heard online as a podcast. Please visit our website, voanews.com/encounter. And we love to hear from you, so send us an email with your feedback to encounter@voanews.com or like us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Today, we're discussing the recent U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accord. My co-host for this program is VOA science correspondent Steve Barragona. In our next segment, again, joining us by telephone are Noah Kaufman, climate economist at the World Resources Institute, and James Taylor, president of the Spark of Freedom Foundation, both located in Washington, D.C. Steve, why don't you lead off?
So every policy change is going to have winners and losers. So I wanted to just kind of lay out, first of all, James, maybe start with you. Who would you say are the winners from this?
I think the winners are the American consumers, American taxpayers, because what we are going to get now is an economy that focuses on affordable energy sources and also ones that reduce carbon dioxide emissions. We're not going to have this top-down mandate from international government bureaucracies. In the United States, we have reduced carbon dioxide emissions during the past 15 years more than any nation in the world. And we've done it because affordable, low-carbon natural gas has replaced coal power. And under these market forces that will continue, with or without Paris, the American consumers will be the winners.
And James, while you're on the topic, there's always a winner and a loser. So who would you say is the loser on this?
I think those folks who would like to see us subject to a United Nations government bureaucracy. Also, the losers might be nations around the world that would be the recipients of cash payments and trade favorability in relation to the United States that would be imposed by the Paris Climate Accord.
And Noah, from your perspective, what do you think, winners and losers from pulling out of Paris?
So Paris is structured so that countries set their own emissions targets and then implement policies to achieve them. So, you know, I think we can talk about economic consequences of particular policies or regulations, but given that it's a voluntary agreement, the only real economic consequences of being in it or not are the diplomatic repercussions of, you know, the United States thumbing their nose at the world like this on the issue of climate change. It's funny, if you go on the website of the organization that actually did the economic analysis that Trump cited, there's now a prominent disclaimer saying that Trump mischaracterized the study as the economic consequences of the Paris Agreement. The other point I would make is just in terms of talking about economic consequences, the real story is the economic costs of inaction on climate change in the long run. So these consequences, we don't know what they'll be for sure, but they could be anywhere from very bad to potentially civilization threatening. So, you know, I think any short run policy costs are going to be dwarfed by the potential economic risks that we are condemning our children and grandchildren to by not acting on climate change.
Since the campaign, the president has been talking up the coal industry in particular, fossil fuel industries. Can you give us a sense of where they stand? I mean, how much do they stand to gain from, obviously, you know, as you mentioned, Paris only did so much, but certainly the president has been making other moves intended to bolster the fossil fuel industries. How much do they stand to gain from those policies?
Well, I mean, I think James said it well in terms of current market forces. Right now, you have markets by themselves moving away from coal, and that's largely due to low-cost natural gas. It's only a small amount of that is regulation. So the coal industry right now is very small. It's about 50,000 workers in the coal mining industry total. And sure, yeah, they may see a little benefit from not moving forward on climate regulations. But again, it's certainly going to be small in the context of the sort of long-run economic costs we're talking about from continuing to burn that coal.
No, some of the economists say that the president's decision to pull out of the Paris Agreement would most likely have a devastating long-term economic consequences for the U.S. and the world. How so?
Well, I see the Paris Agreement as an important first step on the pathway to decarbonization. And you know, the world, over 190 countries came together in Paris and said, we are going to reduce global emissions down to near zero levels by the end of the century, thus holding temperature changes to well below 2 degrees Celsius. Now, the particular commitments in Paris were not strong enough to achieve those goals, but it was certainly a first step in that direction and probably a necessary step. So again, it just takes me back to this point of long-run economic costs of inaction. If you don't take these initial important steps of sort of coming together as a world, it's just scary to think what we are condemning future generations to in terms of economic costs.
James, do you agree that pulling out of the Paris Accords would have devastating long-term economic consequences for both the U.S. and the world?
No, I completely disagree. I believe that the Paris Climate Accords are not a first step, they're a sidestep. If you go back to 2001, you may recall that we had the same argument and the same points being made that because the United States did not sign Kyoto and nearly every other nation in the world signed the Kyoto Protocol, we were outlaws, outliers, and we were sentencing our children to a bleak future through global warming. What's happened since then is global emissions have increased by almost 40%, and U.S. emissions have decreased by 10%. Results in terms of addressing climate change are not going to be determined by what pieces of paper you sign. It's going to be determined by what happens in your economy, what happens with your actual energy choices. With or without the Paris Climate Agreement, natural gas is less expensive than coal, will continue to replace coal. And for people who believe that global warming is a serious crisis, they need to stop opposing fracking for natural gas, which would produce even more of it. They need to stop opposing nuclear power. Nations like India, environmental groups applaud India for becoming carbon-free in much of their power supply and pledging a 40% carbon-free power supply due to nuclear power. And yet they oppose that in the United States. I believe that what will happen in the United States is the more that we have natural gas developing, taking over coal power, which it will continue to do, the more that we have nuclear power. If some of the folks who propose global warming restrictions get on board for nuclear power, like the folks at the Breakthrough Institute, we will have these carbon dioxide reductions continue. I think we will anyway. but they will accelerate under these energy sources in a manner that is cost effective, because these are energy sources that are cost competitive with coal, and wind and solar power are not, unfortunately.
Actually, I've heard the opposite, that wind and solar in a lot of places are actually on parity with natural gas in a lot of places, and the prices continue to come down. There's been a lot of discussion about this, the wind and solar and renewable energies in general, as the industries of the future, and that we're ceding those industries to countries like China. What do you make of that argument, James?
Well, the Brookings Institution, which is a left-of-center public policy organization, so I'm not quoting the Trump administration or conservative think tank, they put out a paper just recently that's entitled Why the Best Path to a Low-Carbon Future is Not Wind or Solar Power. And according to the Brookings Institution, wind power is 50% more expensive than conventional power. Solar power is triple the cost. I mean, these prices have come down some, but those are tremendous price disadvantages versus conventional power. And there's absolutely no need for it, because natural gas cuts carbon dioxide emissions in half. Nuclear power completely eliminates carbon dioxide emissions, as do hydropower. Now, if and when the time comes that wind power and solar power are cost competitive, then market forces will lead to their increasing their market share. And if what some people advocate is true, then this is going to be a self-solving problem. But I think that the best way to look out for our economic future is not to sentence ourselves in the present and the near future to much more expensive energy sources. We need to be promoting nuclear power, natural gas, and hydropower. This will appease conservatives and climate skeptics while at the same time dramatically reducing carbon dioxide emissions.
Noah, I was interested in your thoughts on the economic potential of wind and solar power, and are we ceding these industries to other countries like China?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely not true to say that wind and solar are sort of multiples more expensive in general than sort of fossil fuel power production these days. It just depends on where you're producing the power. In some places, as you mentioned earlier, wind and solar right now are actually cheaper than conventional fossil sources. I think just more broadly, the independent modeling of economists on this issue is pretty clear, and that's if we do want to address the risks of climate change in a cost-effective, economically beneficial way, we need strong policies. Something like a carbon tax that will promote all low-carbon policies roughly equally and let the best technologies win. So right now we've seen huge gains in wind and solar and huge advancements in recent years. And if that continues, they very well might be the technologies of the future that take over the power sector and more.
And James, in certain conservative circles, any tax is anathema. What do you think about a carbon tax?
Well, I don't think a carbon tax is a good idea for a variety of reasons, but I'll give an illustration that will show some of them. In Washington State this past November, there was a ballot initiative that would impose a carbon tax. And what happened was, in order to try to garner some conservative and Republican support, the initiative held that most of the money that would be collected would be given back to the people in the form of tax cuts, in the form of money specially targeted for low-income households. And some of it would also go to environmental programs, but the majority would go back to the people. But what happened is people on the left rallied against the carbon tax initiative because they thought that government should keep all the money in an environmental slush fund. And this is part of the reason why I think a carbon tax is problematic, because for carbon tax to make sense, what it would need to do is it would need to replace the ongoing preferences for wind and solar power. It would need to replace the ongoing preferences and penalties for all sources. And the revenue that would be generated would need to be given back to the people. And right now, politically, that just doesn't seem to work. I think moving forward, the best strategy to reduce carbon dioxide emissions would be to encourage and incentivize energy sources that reduce carbon dioxide emissions while also being acceptable from an economic standpoint.
And with that, James, that is the final word in our conversation. I really appreciate you and Noah joining us today.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
Our guests in this segment were Noah Kaufman, climate economist at the World Resources Institute, and James Taylor, president of the Spark of Freedom Foundation, both in Washington, D.C. And I'd like to thank VOA science correspondent Steve Barragona for coming on today as my co-host.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Also, thanks to Anya Zaleski for booking our guests. Encounter was produced in Washington, D.C. I'm Rick Pantaleo, sitting in for Carol Castillo. Join us again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.